Good morning. Reconvene the hearing. And skydive Queenstown.
Correct.
We have the rules here, Mr. Scott.
Perfect. Thank you very much. My full name is Clark Alistair Scott. I'm the General Manager of Skydive Queenstown Limited, which trades as Enzone Skydive and Skydive Paradise in the Morgue. I'm authorised to give evidence on his behalf. Also with me is Mr. Anthony Ritter, who's a Director of Skydive the Beach, and Mr. Tim Sinclair from MacTog. I was recently appointed to the position of General Manager of Skydive Queenstown Limited in January of this year. Prior to that, I worked for Shot Over Jet for over 22 years and was the General Manager for the last 10. I hold a New Zealand Certificate of Engineering from the Central Institute of Technology. Skydive Queenstown filed two submissions on the district plan, number 23 and number 122, and various further submissions supporting and opposing original submissions of other submitters. The relevance to today's hearing are the further submissions Skydive Queenstown lodged in support of the original submissions of Real Journeys Limited, number 621, Maitahu Tourism Limited, number 716, Tianau Developments Limited, 607, in respect of the Strategic Direction Chapter, the PDP. Those original submissions sought amendments to the Strategic Direction Chapter to provide for greater strategic direction for commercial recreation and tourism activities, their growth, and protection from activities that are inappropriately cited.
Anthony Ritter is my name, as Clark mentioned. I'm one of the directors of SQL. I just thought I'd give the main view of the company, given Clark's recent appointment in the role. I'm also one of the founding directors of Skydive Beach Group Limited, a publicly listed company in Australia, who made the acquisition, which I'll go through. Skydive Queenstown, it was New Zealand's first town of skydive operation, established in July 1990. The previous directors have progressively invested back in the business, developing fantastic facilities and a superior product to any other offered throughout the skydiving industry in New Zealand and arguably the world. It's built an enviable reputation in the adventure market. It offers tandem skydiving, free fall photography, and also some limited learner skydive courses at the drop zone. Business has grown from a team of three to one which now employs, in the recent summer peak, between 70 and 80 employees. And in 2010, SQL, Skydive Queenstown, made a strategic purchase of Skydive Paradise, meaning Lenormandy, now employs 8 personnel as part of that business. That particular business is supported by SQL's administration, operations and marketing over the Jackson Point drop zone. However, both companies stand alone financially, simply sharing the resources to maximise the product delivery and the efficiency. Skydive Paradise also offers tandem skydiving and also handicap photography, slightly different to the Enzone product. Each company shares the same policies, procedures and systems, but they offer a slightly different experience in terms of camera product, which was mentioned. The company's strategy is one that was really attractive to us from Australia. It's always been the focus on the quality and long-term objectives rather than short-term financial goals. They wanted to build a superior product in a robust business, which will in turn result in gaining a strong market reputation. SQL, Skydive Queenstown, has carried out 275,000 customers during its 25 years in operation. Out of interest, not noted on this document, 82% of customers are aged 18 to 34. 93% of those customers are international, 7% are local New Zealanders. And just another interesting stat, China's made up 23.4% of all tandem skydivers in the last 12 months, up from 11.7%. I'm sure you've seen that increase in tourism numbers with the Chinese. Skydive Queenstown, very proud to win the Supreme Winner Award in 2007 for the Tourism Industry Award, and it is New Zealand's largest skydiving operation. How Skydive the Beach Group Limited from Australia ended up standing here before you today. On 30th of October, the publicly listed company Australia acquired the shares of Skydive Queenstown and also Skydive Paradise. Skydive the Beach Group Limited is a company that's been in existence for 19 years, only listed on the ASX back in March last year. In financial year FY16, people complete over 130,000 tandem skydives with turnover of $54.9 million Australian dollars. The board of directors, myself and five other directors, made a strategic decision to enter the Queenstown market given the quality product that Skydive Queenstown offers. It's not only the product, but the sustainability and the viability of this business was very attractive. And it also the fact that it forms one piece of the broader adventure tourism service offering to customers that visit this region. As a means to fund the acquisition of Skydive Queenstown, Skydive the Beach, SKB, went to the market to raise funds through an accelerated non-renounceable entitlement offer. This was oversubscribed. Both institutional and retail investors voted with their own investment in support of the Queenstown adventure tourism market. We have large institutional investor base, such as names of Perpetual, you might be aware of. They're a significant, substantial holder in our business. This investment will allow Skydive the Beach to assist Skydive Queenstown to grow. It will ensure that many more customers that visit the Queenstown region and indeed the broader New Zealand region will be able to experience one of the most spectacular tandem skydives in the world, as most recently Forbes magazine voted End Zone one of the top 10 skydiving destinations in the world. Point four on the document that has been issued, the contribution to the district. I'd like to refer you quickly to Wollongong City Council, which we're Skydive the Beach Group Limited. Founded in Wollongong, it's been in existence since 1999. In late 2015, Wollongong City Council published a document that said that Wollongong, the economic benefits of the region of Wollongong and surrounds was $28.6 million that Skydive the Beach Group would have produced there. Using the same rationale for calculation that the economic benefit that Skydive Queenstown gives the Queenstown economy is in excess of $34 million in New Zealand. We're confident this will only grow. As we improve systems and procedures and techniques that we've got from Australia. Since the acquisition, Queenstown's increased its customer base 20% year on year in comparison.
And just in summing up, Skydive Queenstown considers that aviation, bordery activities play an integral role in supporting the district's commercial, recreation and tourism industries, and that requests that such activities be better recognised, promoted and protected in the strategic direction chapter of the DDP. I've got a couple of councillors sitting here, so just from my point of view, whilst we all know and accept that Queenstown is the jewel in the New Zealand tourism crown, the spectacular scenery and surrounds have no doubt added to the our principality's position. We cannot forget that locally and internationally we are still recognised as the adventure capital of the world, and that's just an important point to underline. Thank you.
Commissioner Cox, do you have any questions?
Yeah.
When you say the last, I'm going to miss something. Sorry to predict. Professor Sacek would be better recognised than the strategic direction chapter. Could you specify how you want to better recognise? Is that the earlier discussion?
I think I can assist with that. In essence, Skydive Queenstown Limited is supporting the relief sought by Real Journeys, Kiara Development. So I think they'll be presenting evidence later in the day. Essentially, they want to see as much recognition as possible in the strategic direction chapter. And they've sought similar amendments with respect to the rural chapter. That's a story for another day.
In that sense, no, I don't want to discuss in rural chapter now, but you're based out there, is it more secure, or are you looking for expansion or what? On the business, I'm talking about land act. You know, where you're operating from, things like that.
In terms of operation numbers, or sorry,
well, just an area. Because this whole plan, if you're wanting to do things and expand the business, it's just a matter of what goes into the plan that obviously enables or restricts that type of activity.
Given the current constraints we're working with,
We've increased, with a few techniques that Australian operations have brought over, we've increased capacity and customer numbers by 20 to 30%. So we believe we'll continue to expand in that form. In terms of further expansion for another day, we'll further submissions will detail that in more detail.
Thank you.
I have a question, gentlemen, for my benefit, because I'm from out of town. Where are you based on the ground?
We have a shop, a retail shop in Shotover Street, 35 Shotover Street. The operations for Endzone is out at Jack's Point, place of the Remarkables Mountains.
It's off the bottom of that map, but perhaps if you...
By the airport?
Go, no, beyond.
No, beyond the airport.
Down
the
road.
Yeah.
It immediately adjoins the Jack's Point zone.
Correct.
Yes.
So you have a base at Arthur's Point, you said?
Jack's Point.
So you're the immediate neighbours down the Kingston Road to Jack's Point?
Correct.
Yes.
Correct.
So we have an airstrip there, an office is there where all our marketing, accounting, and administration staff operate from. That is the base for both businesses. We've got a site down in Wanaki and also that site at Jack's Point.
And where do you take your punters? Where do they skydive?
We take them up. There's an airstrip there.
But do you cover the whole basin? Or
where are you allowed to jump out of a perfectly good plane from?
Yes.
Is it more of a quick one that you want to?
You notice that we're all
we
at 34.
Very, very quick to see, I might add.
What happens, Commissioner Robinson, the plane takes off at Jack's Point, the airstrip there, goes out over the lake and gets the height is 15,000,
yep.
Comes back towards the drop zone and drops the customers down, leaves them at the drop zone. There's a block of land right next to it.
The drop zone is directly next to the
airport.
Yeah. So you don't have to walk too far.
No.
And hopefully you don't get wet.
Yeah, anything above 25 kilometres an hour would be covered. There's safety conditions, obviously, we're here to the CAA. So that's...
I should disclose that my nephew and his friends availed themselves of your service early last year.
Okay.
And I saw some of the photos resulting, so I can convey to my colleagues what was involved later.
Not personally, but...
No.
Were you tempted?
No.
I've never
made that mistake. Do you have any questions? No, I don't have any questions either, thank you. I probably also should disclose that I was the commissioner who heard the objection about the application going directly to the Environment Court for the extension. So I'm quite familiar with the operation of the consultation.
Can I just ask one question? There's no more specificity that you would require in the strategic direction, Jeff, than J and Tiana Developments have asked for. So it's really just the strategic acceptance of the importance of tourism that you want to.
That's right. Increasing the recognition of tourism. And then in the rural chapter, the submission directly touches on and suggests ultra-rail amendments there for agendas and policies.
Okay.
But for the purpose of this, it's supporting those other operations.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, I think you should all have a copy of my submissions for the Certificate of Trust.
Yes.
also have Ms. Taylor's revised. Table. Yes, it was on the table.
Yes, you should have a copy.
Once again, I won't intend to read out the submission in full, and I think I touched on a number of the matters that are addressed in these submissions yesterday, but I'm very happy to return to any of those legal questions as appropriate, and probably a little bit I can add, just having been able to reflect on what I heard yesterday and some of the discussion. But I suppose, just by way of introduction and dealt with in the first part of the submission, I do just want to emphasise the particular circumstances in which this is submitted. There is some history to the development and the consent that was obtained for a dwelling on Roy's Peninsula. And I'm not sure to what extent many of the panel may be aware of that background, but it has a long history. And essentially, the journey for Mr. Greg Marler, who's one of the beneficiaries of the Matukituki Trust, began in 2003. And it wasn't until 2010 that he ultimately gained resource consent. But I set out in the submission in some detail the primary consenting pathway, but there were also a number of side issues that emerged during the course of that period of time in terms of status of farm buildings, a particular plan change promoted by the council to change the activity status, which regrettably wasn't served on the Matukituki Trust, which led to high court proceedings, and so there's quite a complex web. But I don't want to get too caught up in history. But if I can just jump to paragraph 2.9 of my written submissions. And what I've set out there are some of the key findings in the substantive decision of the Environment Court on the version of the proposal that was granted consent. The Environment Court was presided over by Judge McElroy, and in terms of Part 2 and the Section 6 matters that I think are going to be taxing you through the course of this hearing, the Court made a number of findings in respect of the proposal. Generally, it said that the proposal did promote sustainable management in terms of Section 5. In my paragraph 2.9b, it met the requirements of Section 6 by protecting an outstanding feature from inappropriate subdivision use and development.
You can guess the question. Given the timing of Judge McElroy's decision, did he apply what we might call the King Salmon and clarification as to what an appropriate in the context of Section 6B means, or the earlier understanding as drawn from the likes of the wind farm cases?
Yes. It was fair to say more the earlier approach, but the case centred very heavily on the landscape issues and the question of what was appropriate in the context of that outstanding natural landscape and feature. particular landscape we're dealing with here, and the landscapes through much of the region here, of course, are not within the coastal environment. And so I do say that is a distinguishing feature. And so the later guidance delivered by the Supreme Court has to be taken in the context of the NZCPS and the primacy it gives to protecting landscapes in the coastal environment. And that same directive doesn't apply outside of the coastal environment.
The other question about that decision is, did the judge find that you had minor, your client's application had minor effects on the O&L?
Not explicitly. So, because it was going through a full evaluative process and the court wasn't resolving, say, the question of minor for the threshold of notification, what it was focused on was the appropriateness of the development. And I do emphasise my 2.9b, the court's finding there was that it met the requirements of Section 6 by protecting an outstanding feature from inappropriate development. Now that might sound odd because the consent was to enable the construction of a dwelling associated barn and other activities on a sensitive landscape. But what went hand in hand with the proposal was a very comprehensive mitigation regime. Significant planting and a requirement covenant effectively the balance of the land and prevent further development in the future.
Another question of clarification. Given, as Honour Justice Fogarty's assistance in defining the difference between what is mitigation and what is offsetting and what is compensation, where the proposals of your client fit in that dichotomy?
Yes. They were considered as mitigation and as a mechanism of protecting against cumulative or potential adverse effects in the future, in terms of the covenants.
Do you think that the result of that covenant and its mitigation methods are positive in terms of your overall risk management decision?
Yes.
So do you think that objective 3.2.5.1 is currently suggested in our latest redraft that of March, which suggests protection of the outstanding natural features and landscapes from inappropriate subdivision use development? Do you think that that would give equally good results, or do you think it opens it up? Or
yes. So I support, and the trust supports that wording, and in particular the inclusion of the word inappropriate, because as I think I said yesterday, that does enable some examination in the particular circumstances as to what development is or isn't inappropriate. And it can be considered together with mitigation and whether some of what might be offered is considered more an offset or an environmental compensation. Together, they can all contribute to the judgment as to what is appropriate or inappropriate in the circumstance.
But also you run submission at least number two asking for the offsetting aspect, meaning a net environmental gain. No, at least the same or at
more. No net loss or
no
net loss.
Yes, yes. Thank you. Do you agree with that one? You are speaking for a trust that seems to take its responsibilities.
Yes. In my submission, it's not necessary to have specific wording in a plan in order for offset mitigation to be taken into account. I accept it doesn't necessarily fit neatly within avoid, remedy or mitigate, but in terms of an evaluation of the effects of a proposal on the environment, something that is offered up by way of an offset can be a positive effect and it can be taken into account in that way.
Just, I have section 178 of that decision in front of me, and I note that the particular turning point for the court was the large amount of regeneration and the extensive area of development, the mitigation. Well, there was an element of avoiding and an element of mitigation, but the mitigation was substantial.
Yes.
Should we be concerned with wording in the plan that is not ensuring quality outcomes like that and allowing argument by argument as to whether the mitigation or the appropriateness is adequate?
Yes. My submission would be that it's not necessary to have a high level of detail in the plan about the threshold by which something becomes appropriate as opposed to inappropriate. An applicant runs the risk, if they do not put forward a well thought through proposal, particularly in an outstanding landscape and with the increased focus on protection and the emphasis on the language given in the objectives and policies.
Yesterday you referred us to the wording of the NZCPS policies and made the point that they did establish within them what was likely to be and what was unlikely to be appropriate.
Yes.
Why is it appropriate? Well, why is it correct for that to be in the NZCPS and not in the district plan?
So, I wasn't suggesting that it would be possible.
I wasn't suggesting you did suggest that, but
yes.
It is an operative national policy statement. It's a higher order document.
Yes, that's right. So, it does depend on the level of guidance, the level of certainty that the planning authority or the panel here wishes to give. And in some respects, the greater certainty, the better for everybody, in terms of developers who have a better idea of where thresholds are, submitters, and as guidance for the consent authorities implementing the plan.
Just rolling that around, a lot of submitters have suggested we refer to or make explicit reference to avoiding, remedying or mitigating effects. given the potential, as Justice Fogarty has highlighted, for interesting questions as to whether a particular proposal might mitigate, might offset, might compensate, and that if you use the word mitigate, that might be taken to exclude offsetting and compensation. Is that wording that you would support? Or would you seek to find other words like appropriate that enable, yes, or would smooth over those potentially difficult conditions?
Yes. So, if my submission, avoid, remedy, or mitigate, is better than simply avoid, as a first point. If we're talking about a hierarchy of options, because avoid is very directive. And although the Supreme Court does suggest that minor or transitory effects can still be permissible under an avoid policy, I think that's a very difficult threshold, and that many appropriate developments might not pass that threshold. So then in terms of the difficulties with avoid, remedy, or mitigate, I do think the policies could be drafted in a more helpful way. That could include more descriptive language around high-quality environments being enabled that appropriately address adverse effects.
Well, isn't this kind of akin to then defining what's inappropriate and what's appropriate? So, but you said you didn't feel there was a need for that.
It raises the issue, and you could simply leave it as avoid inappropriate development or encourage appropriate development, or the two sides of the coin. I think that would be sufficient, but if you were wanting to give greater guidance, then I do think describing the outcomes with some more particularity in terms of the policies would be helpful.
Can I also ask, the three words, would there be a place where you could just use avoid and remedy? Like you suggest that there's a level of environmental that you don't want to be able to mitigate, it's either avoid totally or fix it as opposed to reduce the
effects. I think there's some difficulties with that, and actually, although there's been a lot of focus on what might fall within mitigation, actually what remedy means is also quite difficult. in some context where an activity has a finite life, it's a quarry, for example, well, there can be conditions and requirements to undertake some sort of remediation and restoration at the end. But if it is something like a residential development that is intended to be permanent, well, is planting, bunding, design, that really to me seems to be about avoiding some effects, mitigating others, but it's actually very difficult to remedy effects in those circumstances.
Thank you.
It does depend on what the value or the metric is. If it's a loss of biodiversity because of vegetation clearance, it may be possible, in a sense, to remedy that by providing for those types of environments elsewhere. So, just at briefly cover off my section three. And just so that the context is clear, the consent that was obtained in 2010 has not yet been implemented. It carried with it a substantial consenting cost, which meant that immediate implementation wasn't going to happen. There was the GFC, and so for a range of reasons, the Mata Kentucky Trust hasn't yet moved to implement it. It is commencing that now, and we have had an initial pre-meeting discussion with the council about how to put this consent into play in practice. Of course, there are some difficulties with some of the conditions, one of which being that it requires 3 years of planting to occur before any structures can be developed. Now, at a practical level, the trust actually sees that it can't efficiently or effectively undertake the planting without constructing the farm barn structure and using it as part of the nursery and storing the relevant equipment that would be needed to undertake the planting. There's also the issue that the trust is committed to a predator-proof fence, and that is likely to be needed early on so that the planting can efficiently and appropriately establish. So there are some wrinkles with implementation. There's also, as I detail in the text there, no bright line as to when the consent might be considered to be implemented. And so we're starting to approach the elapsed period, and there is a potential that the Trust will need to apply to the Council to extend that, or perhaps seek some ancillary or replacement consents. And of course, if it does so, they will be considered against, at least as a relevant consideration, the proposed plan and the objective and policy framework of the proposed plan.
Well, I understand your point that there's no bright line. It seems that from your point of view, or your client's point of view, the trend in authorities away from a bright line that meant that previously was interpreted you had to have exercised or almost completed the exercise of all of a package of consents, presumably means that if the trust does indeed commence, for instance, with a predator-proof fence and extensive planting rolling, there is a high probability that in terms of the solid energy mine case,
yes,
that you will be considered, or your client will have been considered to have implemented the consent, even if they haven't built anything or constructed any structures.
Yes.
Is the fence a structure? Sorry.
Yes, of course. Yes, dwelling structures.
Yes. And look, and I think that's probably right, but there is a risk that someone can take a different view.
Yes, I think I know just the person.
So look, in my section 4A, I do refer to objective 3251. I think that's retained the same numbering. The current version doesn't include the words inappropriate. That's supported. That is what the trust wishes to see. And then it does wish to see that word inappropriate filter through to the relevant policies, both in that chapter, but also chapter 6. And that is to avoid the argument along the lines of the King Salmon and policy 13 and 15, that if the objective says avoid inappropriate development, but then the policies go into further detail and they just use the word avoid without the word inappropriate, then that can colour what is intended by that term inappropriate. Now, if that's intentional, that's a, if you like, a policy decision. But that's why I say some care needs to be taken, even at the policy level, with what language is used, because that will impact on what might be considered inappropriate, even though that word is used unqualified in the objective.
If the policy was framed in the positive, in other words, explaining what is appropriate,
yes,
that presumably would be equally satisfactory.
Yes. And I think, and also, actually, you know, potentially sensible. Paragraph 4.3b, top of page 5, is the other supposed set of phrases that appear in several locations, and that's the suggestion, inappropriate in almost all locations. And the trust does see some danger in that. It's obviously always arguable that for the trust and with its history, that its location and its proposal might still be appropriate going forward.
But I would have thought the trust case was an example of where almost all locations did apply.
Well,
there was only one location that eventually did satisfy the court.
And certainly if that wording remained, then the case of the trust would be, well, that location for the dwelling on the site and in the wider context is one of the exceptions to inappropriate in almost all locations. But the trust does see it as potentially unhelpful should it need to return for a reconsent or extension of lapse.
The question to you is that given your emphasis on commitments that the Trust has given to, in effect, achieve positive environmental outcomes across a very substantial site, a very substantial ONF, is it not just in almost all locations, but almost all cases? Because, as the Chair has identified, that there was some circling round to find acceptable location on the point, but equally it's going to be a rare case that made the extent of a rare application that's going to make the extent of the commitment that the trust has made and to positive environmental outcomes. It might not just be location.
That's right. It may be in some instances not so much about the location but about the proposal and the mitigation or any offset that is proposed. So in informing your views about the text of the objectives and the text of the policies, I do want to touch on the overall broad judgment and what that now means, because in my submission, the overall broad judgment approach to the development of the plan provisions and then ultimately the consideration of resource consents is still alive and well. And I need to explain, it's constrained only in a limited number of circumstances.
And that is where a higher order planning instrument deliberately chooses to elevate one aspect of part two over other aspects. And that's what the Supreme Court said policies 13 and 15 did in the coastal environment. Now, applying that same approach, a regional policy statement, which the district plan also needs to give effect to, it can also choose to elevate protection, for example, over enablement. Now, I'm not aware of any provisions in the RPS that would give that very clear direction.
By that, Mr. Gunn, do you mean the operative RPS?
I mean both, but the operative RPS is what, in terms of the statutory directive, you have to give effect to. And then the proposed RPS is simply a relevant matter for consideration, which is can be odd depending on the timing and the progress of those instruments.
Yes.
Well, just to follow up on that, we've quizzed a number of council about the practical this panel finds itself in, with somewhere between a possibility and a likelihood that before this panel releases its decisions, the proposed RPS will move from being proposed to being operative. And so the first question is, if that should occur, what's your submission to this panel as to what its legal obligation would be?
My submission would be, as soon as the RPS or parts of the proposed RPS or parts of it become operative, then you do have a duty to give effect to it.
And following that up and picking up on your point, parts become operative. Isn't it in fact possible for parts of an RPS to become operative? I mean, what's the statutory provision that provides for that?
I would need to check and come back to you. My assumption, and it's just an assumption, is that parts can be operative or they can be treated as being operative. But I haven't checked the provisions.
And then looking at that, could you look at whether it's that would become operative? Is it at the point that the regional council make it operative, or does it have some effect as for those parts of the RPS that have not been, are not subject to appeal?
Yes, or where, yes, I can check that.
Just cover all the bases.
Yes, so the issue would be working down the possibilities, as you said, in practice operative, where a particular set of provisions has not been subject to appeal to the balance of the document is. One question, does the legal obligation to give effect cut in at that point? Does it meet the definition of an operative RPS at that regard? Or alternatively, is there some mechanism by which ORC could, or the environment for that matter, court for that matter, could declare part of the document to be operative? And if so, what's that mechanism? So yes. those are the issues upon which we'd appreciate your assistance.
Yes, I'd be happy to oblige. And I do know a similar issue arose in the context of the Auckland Unity Plan and the interplay between the old RPS that I think technically they were still required to give effect to, and of course the combined planning instrument that they were resolving, and resolving the higher order provisions before getting to the details. So,
I think, doesn't it also occur with the what is now the operative Auckland regional policy statement for some years that was proposed?
Mm.
It would be helpful if whatever application was given there that
yes.
could be provided to us and how
yes.
that was dealt with.
And look, and I'm happy also to come back to you, you know, not just with the legal position, but in terms of, and it's my understanding that there aren't any sufficiently directive objectives and policies in the RPS that would constrain your ability to apply the overall judgment here. But I'd like to double check that.
And one last circle round for you to ponder. If it was legitimate for the NZCPS to take the view that giving effect to the relevant provisions of Part 2 meant that an avoidance policy was appropriate in the circumstances defined in Policies 13 and 15, would it be equally permissible for this panel to come to the view that having considered all of those issues, it might be appropriate for an avoidance or extremely protectionist policy to apply to some or all of the outstanding aspects in Queensland or something in between?
Yes, it would be permissible. And I think I recalled so much at my paragraph 4.12, and I think the specific passage in the King Salmon decision that effectively supports that is paragraph 149. So it is possible or permissible to come to that position on the basis of the evidence or the policy position that the panel might wish to promote. But what I emphasise is it is not a mandatory requirement because the direct guidance of the Supreme Court in the context of the coastal entitlement certainly doesn't apply.
The question that I have for you arising out of that, with particular reference to the quote that you provided from paragraph 149, is that if provision must be made for preservation and protection as part of the concept of sustainable management, in this case preservation and protection of rowan owls, how in practice could you come up with an overall decision that didn't do that? That is,
so, which returns in part to the question of bottom lines. And I don't think it made it through to the text of the decision, but the Supreme Court certainly, in the context of hearing submissions, seemed to suggest that there were bottom lines inherent in Section 5. But it suggested in the course of discussion, and I can't point to a passage that records this, but suggested that they were the word used, saggy and had some flex in where they might sit.
Mushy bottom lines.
Yes. So I, my submission would be there has to be an element of protection and preservation that is applied to ONLs. And if you ignore that entirely, then that would risk failing to achieve Section 5. where you resolve to set the level of protection and therefore the level of enablement, you can apply the overall broad judgment across the various aspects of Part 2 in coming to that position. And so that's why I say you are empowered still by applying the overall broad judgment. And then it's on the evidence for you where you set the threshold. Okay, we had a brief discussion on most appropriate and Justice Gendel's approach in rational transport. I did take another look at that. And it still presents some difficulty. What he seemed to focus on, and what other decisions have then latched onto, if I can put it that way, is a sentence that says, appropriate means suitable, and there is no need to place any gloss upon that word by incorporating that it be superior. Now, if you're just looking at the word appropriate, well, that probably makes sense. But what that sentence doesn't do, and what Justice Gendel didn't go on to really explain, is what the word most actually means when coupled with the term appropriate. And that is the phrase, most appropriate, that is used in section 32. And so I do say it, really looking at the term appropriate in the context of section 32 could be taken to mean most suitable rather than just suitable. That approach is consistent with several earlier decisions of the Environment Court. I'll come back with the full citations, but there's a case of Abraham Holdings, Judge Smith's division of the court. And he said, the words most appropriate when used in the context of a limited range of options being evaluated may be construed as better. And Judge Shepherd also said something similar. I think in one of my supermarket cases, Progressive and Palmerston North, he put it this way, although it may be ungrammatical to consider one of only two possible outcomes as most appropriate, in the context we must consider which of the two is the more appropriate. And I do think that approach really is consistent with what the phrase most appropriate is trying to achieve in that context.
Do we get back to where we landed yesterday, which is it shouldn't be the worst? But it might be one of a number of others, assuming you have a number of options that are not the worst.
Yes. But I've probably dealt with the discussion on inappropriate. I'm not sure I need to return to that. Again, but one thing, and this isn't in my written submissions, but I think there was a discussion yesterday with one of the other submitters about if development occurs on an outstanding natural landscape, would the landscape still be outstanding? and some experience recently in this particular debate, in a very different context, but in the context of the MV Rena, which ran aground on Astrolabe Reef. And Astrolabe Reef was identified in the relevant plan as an outstanding natural landscape, even though underwater, and as an area of outstanding natural character. Now, the provisions of the regional coastal plan were being resolved after the grounding. And I think ultimately by consent, but it was debated before Judge Smith as to whether or not the effects of the Rena and the remains of the ship being on the reef meant that the reef could no longer be outstanding. And the relevant provisions of the plan maintained its status as an ONF and ONC, ONL and ONF. And the issue, the question again arose in the context of the resource consent application recently granted by a council panel of commissioners chaired by Judge Whiting. And Judge Whiting maintained the view that the reef was still outstanding, notwithstanding significant impacts on natural character arising from the ground. I think as a matter of fact, it must be a point by which development or modification of an ONL may mean that it loses outstanding status. But I think it is clear that there is a level of development can occur, and the relevant landscape will remain outstanding.
Sorry, did you just say that you believe there is development that could mean, a level of development that means that ONL could lose that status?
Yes, yes.
Would not then that the plan had failed and that it would not have protected the ONL? So does that not?
Yes.
So how, if you're saying that that is a possibility and the water is currently suggested, we're not achieving by the question plan, what is that what you're saying? If you're raising the possibility of that.
Yes. So it's a lot, well, I'm suggesting in theory, if a level of development was allowed to occur, and that could be against the backdrop of the objectives and policies, or it could be against a lacuna in the rules, but there would be a point by which a landscape could lose its outstandings.
So would that be because of the level of inappropriateness and or the cumulative nature of civil, and how would you suggest that you think?
Yes, so my submission is it could be either or some combination. And protecting against that outcome can be delivered through the objectives and policies of the plan. And it wouldn't hurt to be explicit about that, and whether that's in the text of a policy or an explanation or a goal, but if it is the intention to ensure that outstanding landscapes remain outstanding, then I think the plan can be very explicit about it.
Well, isn't
it doesn't preclude development.
Yeah, so isn't that what the law is being aimed at with the word protect, i.e. avoid? So when you act some specifics just read and mitigate. But if, in fact, the purpose of the plan is to prevent degradation of ONL is just one what you acknowledge yourself could happen and it tips into non-ONL, then the plan has failed through the realisation of it, perhaps.
Yes.
Is that a
system plan? And so the issue is, well, what meaning is given to protect and how absolute is that? Does that mean avoid? Does that mean no development? And how is that going to be interpreted when coupled with the term inappropriate prevailing. Because my submission is, even on an ONL, some development may be appropriate, and if it's appropriate, it will not change the ONL to something that is then not outstanding.
So does that mean it's the definition of inappropriate or as the alternative, the positive appropriate, that is the vital crux in terms of whether the plan fails to succeed in that protective mechanism?
Perhaps I could assist with that. Perhaps it comes back to your earlier submissions about the plan providing greater certainty in the policies. Would that give an answer to Commissioner Gilmore's questions?
Yes. Well, and look, and that's probably the high watermark in terms of, you know, not wanting to enable development that would cause an ONL to lose its outstandings. Hmm. Now, it may be that the threshold should actually be set lower, but if you wanted to be explicit in the plan that an outcome is that the outstanding landscapes within the district shall not be compromised so that they are no longer outstanding, well, that's a very clear message. Hmm.
Do you need to further define the qualities that make the ONL on a specific basis, or would you just say that they are such large landscapes, being an ONL, and the inherent qualities at all?
Yes. It's something that could be left to be debated later. I do know the approach in sort of that was relevant to the RENA case was that relevant outstanding landscapes were identified in a schedule, and the schedule gave some indication as to what the key values were. And for some of them, it was about the vegetation. For some of them, they emphasized the importance of the cultural landscape. But what that does help with is this idea of certainty, or giving an indication as to what is important to be protected, or for a developer working through a proposal, what might they focus on with their mitigation?
Thank you.
So that schedule you talked about, where was that again?
So that's in the Regional Coastal Environment Plan for the Environment Agency. Look, I actually think I probably, just conscious of time and other submitters, I probably don't need to go through the detail of my 418. I think we've probably covered
it.
Sometimes I get carried away.
It's been very helpful. But I have to say, it's been especially helpful. I think we've discussed it with Commissioner Sinclair and Mr. Robinson. I don't think we have any questions now for Ms. Taylor, because I think you've actually answered essentially the questions we would have put to her about her redrafts.
Yes.
And unless there are any questions from Commissioner Gilmore.
Yeah, I think.
And you offer with those further references, etc., would be very helpful. Thank you. Anything else you want to seek clarification?
Mr. Gardner Hopkins be able to come back with that information?
We are hoping to commence deliberations on Wednesday, so
I can come back if you want to use that after Easter.
Yes, thank you, Ms. Chalmers. Then that would be good. Thank you. Now, I'll just explain to the other submitters who were waiting. We had a gap of about 50 minutes, and so we heard Mr. Gardner Hopkins and Ms. Taylor in advance. So we have sufficient time to hear what we know. So we'll hear Mr. Troll and Mrs. Bunn now, and then we will go on to Queenstown Rafting and have a few seconds.
Snapshot of our family's history in Wakatipu. Our forebears, the Robertson family, on our mother's side, owned this site we're on today. It was originally called Brunswick House. It was sold after nearly a century of ownership in the late 70s. Our grandmother's grandfather was J.W. Robertson, Queenstown's first mayor. Our grandmother ran two tourist flats to supplement the income granddad made as a clerk for the railways working on the steam wall. Our childhood adventures included playing on the bank behind the house just outside the door as we come into this room. Arrowtown and Queenstown were their own separate entities with all services, the exception being the banks, which were only in Queenstown. I remember vividly the first house built on the Calvin Peninsula. My grandmother told the late county council in the mid-1950s that they needed to plan for a city and plan for 50 years out. And here we are today, trying to convince you again to plan for further than 10 years, which I know is all you have to do by law. This district has finite capacity. We have one last chance at planning for a basin full of people and an opportunity, say, with the future urban, rural residential, limited lifestyle blocks, the sports fields, airfields, commercial and industrial zones will be. The more info you have, the harder it will be to change to a different zoning. There is very little land left as big parcels in this basin. You don't have the freedom to leave it until the next plan. Our following comments relate specifically to the Wakatipu Basin. Until the 1970s, the rural area between Arrowtown and Queenstown was just that and comprised approximately 40 to 50 individual farms. Out of those original family farms, those of us still here farming today are Hamilton's and Bunn's on Morgan Ferry Road, Dagg's on Maligans Road, Middleton's and Grant's, Franklin and Queenstown Hill, and Jardine's at Remarkable Station. This started to change in the late 70s with the first major subdivision of any farm. N Forks split his farm into 10-acre blocks around Littles and Mountain View Road to cater for the increase in people wishing to have a smaller lifestyle land area. It would be fair to say today we are far removed from that totally farming landscape of the 1970s in the Wakatipu Basin. Objective 3.2.5.5 recognises that agricultural land use is fundamental to the character of our landscape. Which landscape? The high country or the lowlands? I would think both, but they are two completely different types of farms. Rural needs to be defined for this basin. Yes, keep the bits about traditional farming. They will be needed for Glenorchy, Kingston and Hawea in the next plan, but I doubt very much that they will for the Wakatipu Basin. So then my question to you as a panel is, what do you perceive as rural in the Wakatipu Basin? I would suggest open paddocks with houses surrounded by manicured gardens and mature trees with the odd horse. There should also be a policy that covers all of our high country stations. These are important to this district. The people that run these are your guardians of what you think of as outstanding natural landscape. To us as farmers, it's just simply the high country. The biggest problem we have facing this district is a lack of foresight and planning. My grandmother in the 1950s tried to get the then council to plan for future growth. Dad, while he was on the council from 1970 to 1976, along with Alec Robbins, managed to get a road alignment about 100 metres higher than the present road into Queenstown from Frankton. The road that passed through Man Street to go out at the now Heritage Hotel on Fernhill Road. He was quite disgusted when this started being removed after only a few years. How short-sighted was that? The land around all our towns is a finite resource. Let's plan for its use wisely. We need to identify the bits and the features that are important, and we need to plan for the next 100 years, not the next 10, as we are now. And I'll hand over to you.
I'm going to just talk about the goals and policies that we think need some alteration or changes. So in policies 3.2.5.4.1, it says give careful consideration to cumulative effects in terms of character and environmental impact when considering residential activity in rural areas. We would like you to add in there, please, provide for residential opportunities in appropriate rural locations. Do I need to read through all this? Or just...
No, if you just point us up the highlighted bits that you want to add is probably...
Gotcha. So then again, in policy 3.2.5.4, add into there, please. This is just looking to the more long-term residential activity in rural areas should be planned for in two stages, the next 10 to 20 years, then 20 to 50 years, to allow for an efficient variety of transport systems and the QLDC infrastructure to be planned for. And to add into 3.2.5.5, recognise that agricultural land use and other activities that rely on rural resources. So just add that bit in the middle, a fundamental character of the landscapes. And the next one, we're talking about preference to farming activity, and adding into that also that the viability of traditional farming methods may need to be supplemented by allowing commercial activity in the rural area not directly related to farming. As pastoral farming diminishes in the rural area, a variety of other rural-based activities should be encouraged. And just as an aside, we've seen that already with the abundance of golf courses and just simply areas of open land kept as parks. We consider there are areas in the basin with high landscape value that are rural but not traditional farming that have a residential quality to them. Millbrook is a reasonably dense residential and visitor zone development, but it still maintains a high quality rural landscape, albeit golf course. Threepwood and Jack's Point are two other examples. So I think the policies do not provide enough recognition of diversification in the rural area, so if you were able to add in some policy that enabled us, that would be good. Also, one of the biggest omissions in the strategic direction is rejection of, is the transport interior routes. There should be a goal, protection of all arterial routes, including State Highway 6, and there should be a policy written for each town or area that talks about the efficient transport systems to service these towns, commercial, industrial and rural areas. And then if there was an overview to plan for projected population growth for the next 100 years or so, all the transport routes would then be catered for. I also think this, in this, the strategy chapter, there is no strategy objective for water, which is another very important part of what happens needs to happen. So objective could be
to provide every household and business with clean water that is not depleting the aquifers or groundwater systems of the area. And then you could have a policy such as rainwater tanks to be installed with every new dwelling, either for household or irrigation. And you could, not written in here, but also in the policy statements and the strategy, I think you also need to add in the other services such as sewage and things like that, because really all the Chapter 3 strategy plan is talking about is tends to be urban and residential, and you're not looking at the overall picture of how all that's going to work and fit in. I know you've got it further down the plan, but I just wonder if it should be also outlined in those top chapters so that as a council you know where you're going and what you're going to do next. just carrying on about water. We have enough water in our lakes to achieve this, yet QRDC is still asking every individual landowner to find water from their property or a local water scheme. The Lake Hayes water scheme would be better going straight back into Lake Hayes and trying to maintain that, rather than water taken from a under the Shot Over River and pumped backwards through the system. A rural domestic water scheme could then be provided throughout the whole Wakata Basin that would be sustainable. And with that, it would be pretty simple. If you ran it down to main roads, Fairgrass Flat Road, wherever, you could link in to a lot of those private water schemes. And again, everything would just run literally backwards. I want to discuss a little bit in Chapter 6.
Again, you're going to need to tell us the additions that you're talking about.
Okay. So, 6.3.2.2 allow residential subdivision and development in locations where the district's landscape, character and amenity, visual amenity has the capacity to absorb change. I am still wondering why we're going down the track of being able to, using the main policy of whether you're allowed to do a subdivision or not, is whether you can see it from public or private views. I would have thought we could have much better policies in playing with that. And I've completely left that bit out, I've just realised. So from that, I would think that Marion Reed, in her landscape thing that she had with the map with all the different areas, number 1 to 24 or whatever it was, she started to move down that track of looking at different areas in the basin that had ability to absorb change. And I think that's a much better track to go down than just simply getting somebody's personal opinion that can't be qualified as to whether your neighbour's private view is important or not, or whether a view from a road is important or not. I think somehow we need to change that as it is in the current plan to something that is just a little bit easier, to have a box where you can go tick, yes it does, no it doesn't, that rather than just personal opinion, which is what we've been having to deal with for the last 10 years of various landscape architects who tend not to be on the same page. If you can understand what I mean.
No, I understand.
Yeah. And then I just had to put this bit in. the Arrowtown urban growth boundary needs to be extended to the east to the boundary, the Arrowtown Golf Course and along McDonnell Road, including the land of the Arrowtown South Plan Change. This land has been wrongly described as residential in a report dated the 18th of March 2016, which was put out a few days ago by somebody. You can find it to put the reference in this morning. As residential in open space. It is open space, but it is a special zone which more reflects rural lifestyle, which is shameful misuse of land next to an urban area that is surrounded by modified rural land in the form of golf courses. Extending the urban growth boundary, I've got to this, but I mean to the Arrowtown Golf Course, would then fulfil the objectives of 4.21 and 4.22, which say to allow expansion within an urban growth boundary. There is only expansion in the urban growth boundary as it stands from when the Commissioner put it to put in an extra 30 houses, which isn't a lot. And then, of course, you're hoping to do medium density there. The demand for Arisham is far greater than what is being allowed for. QLRDC is very much a forward-thinking progressive community. Please make this a forward-thinking progressive document. It is the hearing panel is the legacy to be judged on this. And then on the back page, we just provided a very brief summary of what was asked yesterday regarding our irrigation system.
Thank you.
Yeah. So just the first bit is just a very brief history of the irrigation scheme. Basically, it was designed in the 1930s to service 4,000 acres of farmland in the Wakat Basin by flood irrigation. It covered all the way to Lake Johnston, Franklin Flats, or Franklin Flats, down to Wimpy Ferry. There were three water lines. Those three water lines are pretty much still in use today. The only line that isn't in use is the one that goes out past Lake Hayes to pretty much around what they call the Lake Hayes line. Over the years, some of those lines have been removed, but pretty much now they're all back in place. Remarkables Park have just recently put in a pipeline under the airport to get water to there. The Queenstown Events Centre, every year when they run the Arrow Franklin domestic water supply system, will wander along to the irrigation company and ask them if they can get water off them. But they never have come up with the money or the headworks to do it, and then they forget about it till the following year. So they're really the only major area that isn't actually on the Lake Hayes water system that needs land water for what we would call, what I would call rural use or paddock use, that rather than domestic use, they're using domestic water. So the water is now supplied to all those things that I've put on there for irrigation use or other use, and it would be fair to say that if the pipe burst in the irrigation system 3 or 4 weeks ago when it was really dry, Waikato Golf Course and Millbrook would have been in absolute dire straits because they use a significant amount of water. And this year, especially being so dry, it's been a major absolutely, yeah, I was just trying to think of the right words, but that's what they are. And so that's when we said yesterday that there perhaps should be something underwater. Again, there should be a policy in there and a strategic direction underwater that this system is looked after within the district because it is such an incredible, incredibly important part of what happens in our district as far as infrastructure and water is. And I know that over the years, the council have battled every subdivision development that has water going through it because it's never recognised within the council.
Thank you. Now, any questions, Commissioner Cox?
No, it's all pretty clear. But did you say that last sentence again? What you just said? I didn't hear what you said.
Quite a few of the rural subdivisions that have happened over the past, say, 10 to 15 years, the Arrow Irrigation Company has a legal 6-metre easement with the water race, and there's been a number, and one that I can recall quite vividly, my partner was on the irrigation committee, was at Franklin behind Terrace Junction, and they wanted to build the Terrace Junction right up to within the water race, and the irrigation company had to... It took quite a lot of legal work to get that sorted out because it wasn't within the council to talk to the irrigation company when they saw the irrigation race going through the title to sort it out. And the most recent example that they've had, and they've had to battle considerably about it, is the roundabout at Grants Road. That roundabout cuts right through the legal water race, and I know Nigel, and Tony Strain, chairman of the Nigel's, person who runs it, Tony Strain's chairman of the irrigation system, they have stood on the side of that road battling both transit and all the contractors saying, you have got to keep this irrigation race in place. and it took a considerable amount of their time that didn't need to keep that in place, because it wasn't planned for when they did the roundabout.
Understood. I'm
looking into it. Yeah. Thank you. You mentioned under 3.2.5.2 on your second page, and also the original submission, that we need to plan for two stages. And so I'm just wondering, in your original submission, you said the UQB needs to be twofold of the force of 10 and then again at the next 50. Are you basically suggesting a deferred development zone, so or in the current UQB and a future UQB?
I am. I think you could do something like Marion Reed's report and just take the whole Wakatipu Basin and say, okay, transport routes are the overlying thing. Let's see how we're going to get our people in and out of the basin. And then, we're going to need more commercial land in the next 20 years, because Franklin Flats will be full. Where is it going to go? We're going to need more industrial land. Where is that going to go? We're obviously going to need more urban development in the rural area, and I know we're trying very hard not to do that because you've put much greater densities into the towns, which I think is fantastic, and I agree with that completely, but it's not going to be the end of the equation. You are going to need somewhere out there in the rural area another township, whether it be the next 5, 10, 15 or 20 years, but if you don't say where that township's probably going to go now, when you get to do that, how many houses are on that area, and how are you going to plan for the infrastructure?
Okay, so what you're considering is rather than a secondary level of UGB, it's suggesting a whole new UGB. I thought you were suggesting that the current UGB would have a deferred zone UGB around existing, but what you were suggesting is actually a new
overlay the district and see what it's going to think what it's going to look like 50 years.
Then you also say on your first page, the more info you have, the harder it will be to change to a zone. So that's with regard to that, as opposed to the info within the existing UGBs.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, I'm probably thinking more in the rural
area. Okay, that wasn't clear.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So Marion Reed's landscape assessment report, you basically agree with that and feel that the principles contained therein should be applied to identify where the places that could absorb change are, and therefore where should there be new township?
I read that and I thought that it was a really nice change from what we've been going down before. And I did read it in depth several times when we were looking at it. And I don't agree with everything that she has in there, but the overall concept is good. Yeah.
Yes. That's one more question, Rose. Back to your recommendation change to 3.2.5.4.1. When you mentioned, you say provide for residential opportunities, and following on what you've indicated about having a residential area, what do you mean by residential opportunities? What do you envisage from that policy enabling?
There's definitely a greater need in the Wakatipu Basin for more rural residential zoning. There's been none provided for in the plan. There's been a lot of extra rural lifestyle zoning provided for. And some of the extra rural lifestyle zoning that counts in the zone, if they actually looked at the densities within that zoning, it's actually already rural residential.
I just got one map that you could clarify me. When you talk about the water objective, well, particularly the policy about rainwater tanks, but do you mean really water storage?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Thank you. I just want to put, you know, about your more general submissions about what a rural character. Talked a lot about various submissions about what it is that makes an area rural, and when does it cease to be rural? And I suppose the proposition I've put to you by your comment is that something real farm, like the one you run, mm-hmm. but it looks like a farm, like maybe grazing someone else's stock. But is that it, or is it something else to your mind?
Well, rural in my mind is farmland such as Southland, and yes, we do have a rural concept in the Wapitiki Basin. Our farm is very much still rural, it's still as it was 60 years ago, 50 years ago, albeit with extra houses around it than it did then. That's why I asked the question to you, what do you as a panel and what do our visitors perceive as rural?
Do you consider Dalefield to be rural, which is lifestyle blocks? Is that rural?
Yes,
it is. Yeah.
I think that's what Commissioner Robinson was trying to give
you. Yeah, I think in this basin it would be classified as rural, yes, although it does have a high density of housing on it.
And I suppose the thing that I was bouncing off was your reference to manicured gardens, because to me, I grew up in Southland and there's not a sheep on it, it's not a real farm. That's a manicured garden to me is not rural. That's may not be urban, but it's not rural either.
Mm.
And so, like, that's just a personal.
Well, I think that's the question that we're asking too.
Mm.
You know,
what was your answer?
You know, if you're a rural person who lives on a farm in Southland, if you come up to Queenstown, you don't believe there's any rural in the Wapitiki Basin, essentially. And I think the definition of rural in the Wapitiki Basin is anything outside the town boundaries. And there has been a lot of, you know, you hear a lot of negative discussion about rural development, but there have been some absolutely amazing rural developments in this basin. Look at Threepwood, it's fantastic. Look at Millbrook, Jack's Point, they're great developments. They don't destroy the character of the landscape at all, but there's some pretty high density residential in those areas. It's great, and the people who live in them love living in them.
Thank you.
Thank you. There's no further questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Now we have Queenstown Rafting.
May it please the panel, I'm Tim Sinkley from Mac Tonic. Joining me is Mark Boyd, the Managing Director of Queenstown Rafting Limited. You should have a copy of this thing.
Yes, yes, yes.
So I'll just turn it over to Mr. Boyd.
Yes, good morning. My full name is Robin Vance Boyd, and as has been said, I'm the Managing Director of Queenstown Rafting Limited, and I'm authorised to do evidence on its behalf. I've been actively involved with Queenstown Tourism as an owner and manager since 1987. Queenstown Rafting was formed in 1996 as a joint venture between our family trust and Real Journeys, which was then known as Fuel and Travel. At that time, the local rafting industry was in a poor state with too many operators for the available business, and public confidence had been eroded by a number of accidents. The fallout from these generated months of adverse media publicity. And I'll be making submissions later in the year about our own submission, but the sort of thing I was talking about was that kind of stuff, which some of you will be remembering. During the past 28 years, I have advocated the benefits of responsible tourism at a national and local level. I'm a past chairman of Destination Queenstown, that's our local promotion association, and have served on the board of the Tourism Export Council. I'm currently a member of the Otago Conservation Board. Queenstown Rafting Limited operates whitewater rafting trips on the Shotover and Karawa rivers, as well as a multi-day trip on the Landsborough River. Many of these trips involve elements such as helicopters, bungee or jet boat. We also operate a bar restaurant at our operating base at Arthur's Point. In addition to these premises, we have a retail shop and offices in the Queenstown CBD and a bus park in Gorge Road. Queenstown Rafting operates in conjunction with our sister company, Venture Discovery Limited, which trades as Team Discovery. So my submissions and further submission are that Queenstown Rafting filed a submission on the proposed district plan, and our number was 167. Generally speaking, Queenstown Rafting's submission focused on the public safety aspects or boating aspects and activities in the district. Queenstown Rafting Limited also lodged various further submissions supporting and opposing original submissions of other submitters. They'll be dealt with when the rural zone provisions are heard. Of relevance to today's hearing is the further submission Queenstown Rafting lodged in support of the original submission of Rural Journeys Limited, number 621, in respect of the strategic direction chapter of the proposed district plan. The original submission of Rural Journeys Limited sought amendments to the strategic direction chapter to provide for greater strategic direction and or recognition for commercial recreation and tourism activities, their growth and protection from activities that are inappropriately cited. Queenstown Rafting Limited believes that commercial recreation and tourism activities play an integral role in supporting the district's economic, recreation and social network, and that such activities ought to be better recognised, promoted and protected in the proposed district plan. I have read the stated evidence to be presented on behalf of Rural Journeys Limited and others by Ben Farrell, and I think that's coming up later. Queenstown Rafting supports the amendments to the strategic direction chapter of the plan sought in Mr. Farrell's statement of evidence. In addition, Queenstown Rafting Limited supports Mr. Farrell's proposal that there should be a separate water zone to recognise the special nature and values of water, rather than having water as part of, generally, the rural chapter of the proposed district plan. I believe that in terms of tourism, the use of water and surrounding land requires consideration to be given to the environment, sustainability, visitor experience, and particularly safety, as well as the usual matters. Matters affecting safety go well beyond any particular operation, and the stability and credibility of the local industry as a whole is at stake. And I think just as a side comment, water internationally is becoming a commodity which is becoming increasingly valued and its protection internationally is recognised as being necessary. And I think that its own chapter of the plan would be of real benefit to this district. The Section 42 report, Kira Queenstown Rafting Limited supports Mr. Pax's recommendations to bolster provisions in Chapter 3 of the proposed district plan in respect of tourism activities. Our contribution to the district. Contribution made by Queenstown Rafting Limited is typical of that made by many medium-sized tourism businesses. It may be thought surprising that many similar tourism operators have not taken the opportunity to submit on the plan. However, the timing of notifications of the plan coincided with a very busy period, and many managers and owners would simply have been too stretched catering to a demand that they saw coming up over the holiday period. And unfortunately, time goes by fast in our environment, and I think before they knew where they were, they missed out. Queenstown Rafting and Kiwi Discovery employs around 70 staff. It follows that the district gains from the benefit of the wage expenditure from these people. In addition, on average, around 80% of all other company expenditure is made to businesses in the district. Some of these businesses are other tourism companies who provide us with services such as helicopters, while others are in the trades and services sector. Apart from payments to government,